I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Officials say Ukraine fired several American-supplied longer-range missiles into Russia, marking the first time Kyiv has used such weapons since the start of the war. A Telegram channel affiliated with the Ukrainian military posted a video on Tuesday that it says shows a U.S.-supplied missile being fired from an undisclosed location in Ukraine. The Kremlin said Tuesday that it shot down 5 Army Tactical Missile System missiles and damaged a 6th, and that debris fell on an unspecified Russian military facility in the Bryansk region. The use of the long-range missiles came as Russian President Vladimir Putin formally lowered Moscow's threshold for using nuclear weapons. U.S. officials said on Tuesday the Pentagon will send Ukraine at least $275 million in new weapons. It comes as President Joe Biden's administration works to do as much as it can to help Kyiv fight back against Russia in the remaining 2 months before President-elect Donald Trump takes office. Trump has vowed to quickly end the war. U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein held what he called very constructive talks with Lebanese officials in Beirut on Tuesday about a possible ceasefire in the Israel-Hezbollah war.
Today, we continued to significantly narrow the gaps.
Hochstein visited Lebanon's capital a day after Hezbollah reportedly gave a positive response to a U.S. draft proposal to end the 13-month war, which the Lebanese group launched to support Hamas in Gaza. The U.S. proposal could see Israeli ground forces leave Lebanon and Hezbollah militants withdraw away from the Israeli border. More Lebanese army troops and UN peacekeepers would be sent to a buffer zone in southern Lebanon as part of the deal. This is VOA News. New York prosecutors who secured the first ever criminal conviction of a former U.S. president said on Tuesday the hush money case against Donald Trump should not be dismissed in light of his election victory. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
78-year-old Trump had been scheduled to be sentenced on November 26th, but Justice Juan Merchan last week put all proceedings on hold at the request of Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. And prosecutors raised the possibility of a 4-year pause in proceedings, which could resume after Trump leaves the White House. In May, a jury found Trump guilty of falsifying business records to cover up a $130,000 payment to adult film actress Stormy Daniels. The money was meant to buy her silence before the 2016 election about a sexual encounter she says she had with Trump. Trump denies the affair and pleaded not guilty at trial. Trump's lawyers urged Merchan to dismiss the case, arguing that having it loom over Trump while he was president would cause what they called unconstitutional impediments to his ability to govern.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. The U.S. government has recognized Venezuelan opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez as the president-elect of the South American country months after President Nicolas Maduro claimed to have won the July election. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recognized Gonzalez on Tuesday in a post on X in which he also demanded respect for the will of Venezuelan voters. The Biden administration has said Gonzalez earned the most votes in the disputed July 28th election. Brazilian police announced on Tuesday the arrests of 5 people suspected of involvement in an alleged plan to kill then-president-elect Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in 2022, days before he took office. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston reports.
Brazilian police say President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva could have been killed before his inauguration in 2023. They uncovered a military plot to kill the then president-elect days before he took office and stage a coup. The army confirmed current and retired military officers were arrested, including one who was a member of former President Jair Bolsonaro's cabinet. Documents seized by police show how the plan was to shoot or poison Lula and his vice president-elect, put retired army generals and other officials in charge, and then hold new elections. Lula defeated Bolsonaro in the 2022 election.
Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Mozambique's post-election violence looms high on the agenda as SADC leaders meet in Zimbabwe today, Wednesday.
The situation in Mozambique can only be resolved by a possibility of the SADC leaders asking Mozambique to consider a government of national unity.
Opposition leader Abdi Rahme Mohamed Abdullahi Iro has won Somaliland's presidential election. Anti-corruption protesters in Botswana demand action from their new government. The G20 summit has ended in Brazil. What's in it for Africa? The wife of Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Chisa Besigye says her husband was kidnapped in Kenya and is being held in a military jail in Uganda.
He was kidnapped, and I don't know what condition he's in. I actually heard that he's not well, so I'm very worried about him.
And at the G20, experts say alleviating poverty can mitigate migration crisis. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An analyst says the Southern African Development Community's SADC leaders, who are meeting today Wednesday in Zimbabwe's capital Harare, should propose a win-win solution to the post-election crisis in Mozambique. There has been violence there since opposition parties and citizens rejected the results of the October 9 presidential election. Human rights groups say as many as 20 people have been killed. Professor Sipo Sipi is a political analyst and the former deputy vice chancellor or institutional support at the University of Zululand. He tells me that SADC should propose a government of national unity, given the many problems associated with the October 9 vote.
The situation in Mozambique can only be resolved by a possibility of the SADC leaders asking Mozambique to consider a government of national unity. One needs to understand that what will drive them will be some contextual issues. The widespread of violence post-elections is so much that it cannot be resolved by simply quelling it through brutal force. And secondly, the turnout was so low, less than 43%. When a party has been in power for a long time, the results should indicate that the outcome will move towards the 50s. Then the third aspect is that the observers in the area, especially international observers, have also found the elections not to have been free and fair, in the sense that one, there was a lot of intimidation. Two, there was also vote rigging. Three, there was also the ballot stuffing. All these issues would suggest to the people who are going to go there to say, maybe it is about time that we try to find a win-win solution where the ruling party will still be leading government, but it will accommodate the opposition.
Professor, let's assume the SADC leaders take your position. Wouldn't it implicate some of them? Because my understanding is that some of them have come out recognizing the government.
Yeah, no. They will be implicated. But the point is that they cannot turn a blind eye to the violence that ensued. And all they need to do is to put the people of Mozambique first and also the stability of the region. Because remember, the SADC region and other countries are also invested in the stability of Mozambique. Because once you have the mayhem and anarchy continue, that will spill over to countries like South Africa, to Swaziland, to other countries.
Talking about regional stability, I did not know that Mozambique plays a very crucial role in terms of the economy in the Southern African region.
You need to understand it from the perspective that all countries that have coastal regions become also the gateway to international trade. So the port in Mozambique is critical in that sense, South Africa and for the other countries in the neighborhood. So it is also for that reason that the notion of stability becomes very important. That's why I'm saying that SADC countries are also invested, both economically and politically, because if there is no resolution, then we are going to suffer.
Professor Sipo Sipi is a political analyst and the former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. Opposition leader Abdi Rahme Mohamed Abdullahi Iro has won the breakaway Somaliland's presidential election, defeating incumbent Musi Bihi Abdi. Abdirahman Iro, candidate for the Wadani National Party, captured 63.92% of the vote, compared with Bihi's 34.81%, according to the Electoral Commission. A third candidate, Faisal Ali Warabi, received 0.74% of the vote. Ethiopia, Somalia, and the U.S. Embassy in Somalia were among those who congratulated the new president-elect. The international community hailed the election as peaceful. Musa Hassan Yusuf is the chief of the Somaliland National Electoral Commission. He spoke with Haroon Maruf of VOA's Horn of Africa service.
I think the nature in which we have conducted this election has been one that was quite sensitive, in the sense that because of the delays to the presidential election, the last 2 years have been extremely difficult in terms of political sensitivities and political disagreements. And also there were some legal gaps within the legal processes. So towards the beginning of this year, maybe the end of last year, there was a political consensus that allowed the path for this election to happen. So given all that, we were extremely pleased that the election happened peacefully.
What's your takeaway from this election?
We are going to be doing post-election review as soon as possible. But of course, we have a lot of lessons to learn. This was the first time we were implementing the IRIS biometric voter verification system. We have captured a lot of lessons learned. And we have also got other lessons that we can implement to improve upcoming elections for the future.
What was the turnout?
So the turnout was 53%, which we were hoping that it would be a lot higher. But at the same time, we're pleased that those that did turn out voted very peacefully, and there was no single incident across the country.
What do you attribute for the low turnout?
There are many factors that can be attributed to that. I think one major factor is the nature of these two elections were very different. A lot of people might have felt confused. They might have felt that, you know, the political party's election and the presidential election were huge. Yeah, so there are many, many other factors that might have contributed to the low turnout.
Has the incumbent president, Musa Bihi Abdi, did he concede?
Well, we are hearing that he has conceded, but we have not heard of any official information regarding that. So we hope that, I think, in the coming days that he will concede and he will accept the results.
What does this election mean for Somaliland and for your commission?
That's a very important question. For the commission, I think the pressure was immense. There were a lot of doubts within the elite of Somaliland, whether we as commission were able to deliver this election and deliver it on time and deliver it with certain degree of credibility. Then also we know the dynamics, the geopolitics of the region. With that in mind, the stakes were very, very high, and we did our best. And thank God everything went smooth and everything went well. And for us as a commission, we're very grateful to God how it went. And we're very pleased with the processes. For Somaliland, I think it means a lot. It means that there were a lot of external factors that maybe would have liked the election not to have happened peacefully. So to know that, we also thank God, and we also thank the people of Somaliland for making that happen.
Musa Hassan Yusuf is the chief of the Somaliland National Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Haroon Maruf of VOA's Horn of Africa service. The wife of Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Chisa Besigye says her husband was kidnapped in Kenya and is being held at a military jail in Kampala. The story broke early Wednesday morning, local Uganda time, and we have not been able to reach Ugandan authorities for confirmation. However, Winnie Byanyima, who is also the executive director of the United Nations AIDS agency, UNAIDS, says her husband went missing on Saturday in Nairobi, where he had gone to attend a book launch by Kenyan opposition leader Martha Karua. Byanyima tells me that the family is demanding to see Dr. Besigye.
Dr. Bessie flew to Nairobi on Saturday. He was going to attend a book launch by the Honorable Martha Karua, who's written a book. And that was to be on Sunday. He checked into a hotel in Nairobi and then went out with a friend he had come with, a political activist like himself, and they went for a meeting somewhere in a suburb called Riverside. He actually gave the address, exact address of where he was going, to another comrade in Uganda. He took a taxi. The taxi got him there and he asked the taxi to wait for him. So clearly it wasn't going to be a long meeting. But the taxi driver waited and waited and kept sending him text messages that he wasn't answering. And the taxi driver says he left the place of the meeting. It was an apartment at 4 o'clock in the morning. Sunday he didn't show up for the book launch, and Martha inquired amongst mutual friends in Kenya. Some who confirmed to her that he was in Nairobi, he did arrive in Nairobi, they knew he was, but didn't understand why he didn't come. But they were not alarmed. They thought maybe something happened to him, he would soon let us know. Back home in Uganda, they knew he was at the launch on Sunday. On Monday, that's when they started looking for him on phone, and his phone wasn't answering. On Monday, we all began to worry, and the search started. So until I finally traced it down to him, we had a source, a media person who has contacts with the military in Uganda, gave us a hint.
Winnie, that's what I want to ask you, because you are blaming the Ugandan government of being responsible for the disappearance of Dr. Besigye. How did you know that?
I have now got it reliably. Once I suspected that he was being held in a military prison, I went directly to some of my contacts in the military, and it was confirmed to me that he's being held here in Kampala in a military prison. I now have it reliable, but I don't have it officially, so I'm still looking at him as a person who's missing. The word of some soldier doesn't mean anything, because I don't know exactly in which prison he's in. I hear it's a military prison, but they've admitted that they are holding him.
If it is true now that the Ugandan government is holding him, why would they be holding him in a military jail?
I don't know, and it is very, very annoying and worrying for me, because they've done this to him before. They've arrested him and held him in a military jail. We had to go to a court and get an order for him to be released from a military jail, because he's not a soldier. He retired many years ago. He's a civilian. If he's done anything wrong, according to the government, they know what to do. They should bring him before a civilian court. He has a right to bail. He should apply for his bail. He has a right to lawyers, and he has a right to family. But just to be missing in Kenya and then he shows up in the jail suggests that he was kidnapped. He was kidnapped, and I don't know what condition he's in. I actually heard that he's not well. I got a leak from someone that they saw a doctor being taken there to see him where he is. So I'm very worried about him.
Winnie Byanyima is the wife of Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye. She was speaking with us from Munich, Germany. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 20th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Botswana's new president, Duma Boko, has promised zero tolerance for graft in his administration. The pledge comes as scores of Botswana residents join in a youth-led anti-corruption protest urging the government to prosecute former officials accused of looting public coffers. Mkudise Dube reports from the capital, Gaborone.
Activist Sitlomo Tshwanelang mobilized the protest over alleged corruption within state enterprises. He says more demonstrations are on the way and that the new government must prosecute anyone who stole public funds. He says We want change. We will die for those changes. We'll make sure that the change is okay. We'll see to it that things are done accordingly in our country. Tshwanelang further says there's a lot of corruption in government institutions. Mutswari Mohopane is an investigator for Botswana's Directorate on Corruption and Economic Crime. He says his office has seen an increase in the number of reported cases of corruption.
Of course, we are having a problem of corruption in the country. This is reflected by the number of cases we receive and also under investigations. So the report shows an increase in the number of cases that we receive. There is that need to actually sharpen our swords and fight the corruption.
President Boko says there will be an audit of the state coffers to see if any corruption occurred. His government has reported the country is broke. Boko told new members of cabinet Monday that under his administration there will be no room for corruption.
There will be no corruption. First, because I expect that we will uphold the highest standards. But secondly, and more critically, we will put in place very robust institutions and practices that will ensure that there is no corruption, because we have to do this so that even as we police ourselves, we must always know there are institutions and structures that are exerting influence and providing oversight and ensuring that we all stay on the straight and narrow.
Boko took office on November 1 after his party, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, defeated the Botswana Democratic Party, which had ruled the country since independence in 1966. Boko's predecessor, Mokgweetsi Masisi, maintains he has not been involved in any illegal activity and will avail himself for questioning in case of any investigation against his former administration. Mkhondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
Leaders of the world's major economies on Tuesday concluded their annual G20 summit in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, created in 1999 in response to a series of major international debt crises. The group of 20 aims to unite world leaders around shared economic, political, and health challenges. Adi Ismail Samata is a professor at the University of Minnesota. He tells reporter Douglas Mpuga that Africa does not benefit much from such summits.
The G20 are talk shops, and it's good for those who have authority and who have sort of determined the fate of their countries, whether it's the United States or Britain or Russia or India or whatnot. African leadership across the continent, in my opinion, have no reason to be there. They have nothing to show to the world. And the question becomes, unless the continent internally gets sorted out, and therefore these AU, the regional blocs, mean something materially substantive for their people, they will just be showing in China, or they'll be showing in France, or they'll be showing in the United States, and it absolutely adds no value to the collective well-being of the people of Africa. That's my concern with people who are showing up in these sort of powerful meetings without having any leverage themselves.
Many people across the continent are excited that at last South Africa is going to be hosting the next G20 summit in 2025. What do you think about that?
It's an honorable thing to host other people to come to your country. But in the world of competition, and in the world of employment, and in the world of well-being, and in the world of education, and in the world of technology, you have to have something to put on the table that others will take note of. What do we have to put on the table as Africans in these forums? Oftentimes we are there to beg, and to beg in sort of a not dignified manners. And so what leaders in Africa should be doing at home first, before they can aspire to be in these places, in my opinion. What does it add to the employment factor in South Africa, or in Namibia, or in Zimbabwe, or Botswana, or any of that region? So the question is, what I have learned as a member of the Pan-African Parliament is that we talk a lot and we do very little work. And our people are hoodwinked into thinking that our leaders are going to sort of bring the bacon home, so to speak. So I think it's actually more of a shame rather than anything else to host these meetings when you have actually nothing to put on the table.
That's Abdi As Ismail Samatar, a professor of the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali Parliament. He spoke from Minneapolis, Minnesota with Douglas Mpuga. Experts say poverty and hunger are major factors in the global migration crisis. On the sidelines of the G20 summit in Brazil, They said that putting in place effective social safety nets can help mitigate the root causes that compel people to leave their homes. VOA's immigration reporter Alain Barros has more from Rio de Janeiro.
Steve Said was a political science student in Haiti. He left in 2023 because there were no jobs there. Security was a concern. The 22-year-old says he needed to try for a better life.
Because
the situation there is difficult.
I chose Brazil because I heard Brazil of work opportunities.
To get to Brazil, he crossed without documentation into the Dominican Republic. He says it was dangerous and expensive.
The first time, I did not get in, but I went back to the border.
Said spent a month in the Dominican Republic. He worked and saved money. After a month, he got a humanitarian visa and now lives in Brazil seeking economic stability.
In life, you can't stop.
If you need to get somewhere, you have to fight until the end.
According to the Brazilian Federal Police, about 164,000 Haitians live in the country. And as Brazil hosts leaders from the world's 20 largest economies at their summit in Rio de Janeiro, experts say G20 countries need to have ready the resources to integrate migrants into their new homes.
Paulo Illis is the founder of the Center for Human Rights and Immigration Citizenship in São Paulo.
That must always be addressed from a human rights perspective. Additionally, G20 leaders should acknowledge that migration also occurs due to structural issues such as poverty, environmental disasters, wars, and conflicts.
In its declaration, the G20 agreed it is important to prevent irregular migration and respond to the root causes of displacement, such as hunger and poverty. Wellington Dias, Brazil's development minister, says 2.4 billion people worldwide live in poverty.
Migratório.
But beyond the migration issue, I always argue that hunger and poverty are not just problems for those who are hungry or living in poverty. It's a problem for middle class, for the wealthy, for rich countries, and for wealthy individuals.
Gia says people in desperate need might turn to crime, creating problems for everyone. So a key initiative at the summit is the creation of the Global Alliance Against Hunger and Poverty. The alliance aims to provide cash transfers for 500 million people and school meals for 150 million children. More than 80 countries, 24 international organizations, 9 international financial institutions, and 31 philanthropies have joined so far. According to the United Nations, the relationship between food insecurity, migration, and displacement is heavily influenced by climate change, natural disasters, conflicts, and poverty, the major themes during Brazil's G20 summit. Aline Barros, VOA News, Rio de Janeiro.
The mausoleum where the scant remains of Democratic Republic of Congo's fiery independence hero Patrice Lumumba are interred has been vandalized, the country's culture minister said on Tuesday. The French news agency AFP reports that a tooth is all that is left of the anti-colonialist icon and the first prime minister after the country gained independence from Belgium in 1960. That's it for this Wednesday, November 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming on board with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Streets of Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.
We are bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices. Our voices. Right here on VOA.